welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We're here with Salvatore Payne, author of Last Call in the City of Bridges. This is Renee, and I'm drinking a tangerine wheat beer from Lost Coast Brewery. I'm so excited it came back out again. I almost bought the Blue Moon Agave after Jessica spoke so highly of it, but then I knew that it would just sound like I was copying Jessica. And I know I'll never be Jessica. Anyway. How are you doing and what are you drinking?
I am doing very well. I'm currently drinking Knob Creek whiskey on the rocks. I'd started with beer. I was drinking Tecate, which is, I don't even know I have it. I just found it in my fridge. And the Knicks were on tonight, and it was a playoff game. It was game 5 of the Knicks-Celtics series, if any of you recall that. By now, it's probably all over and everything's been decided, but it was a pretty depressing game, so I quickly moved to liquor.
Is that a Kentucky whiskey?
Knob Creek? I think so. I'm pretty sure it is. But I'm not sure about that.
I was thinking about Knob Creek Gun Range. I hate that they made a show about it, because now there's just another Kentucky series. I don't know.
I love that Dick is complaining about Kentucky stereotypes, because every time he says he's doing something insane, he's like, that's just Kentucky.
I'm allowed to, though.
So what are you drinking, Dakota?
I'm drinking Very Old Barton, of course. Made in Kentucky.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, right down, you know what, right down the road from me, I believe. From Bardstown. It's off. It tastes terrible.
Jessica, what are you drinking this week?
PBR. I didn't dress up for you guys this week. I'm sorry.
I'm literally in a dress right now. I literally am dressed up.
Oh.
I mean, not for the show, just in general. I had things to do today.
We can't see you, so you didn't have to do that. But
right? But I got to say it. All right. So we got a lot to cover on this episode because listeners at home may not know this, but Sal, you do a lot of stuff.
I do. I do a lot of things.
I mean, we're going to talk about all the things you do, because some of those things are personal, you know, whatever. I want to say, I've been getting ready for this show today, and I was really excited to talk to you about Last Call in the City of Bridges, which I understand is your first novel.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
And
it is my first book.
And congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
One of the things that I think is interesting to hit on is that a lot of what happens in the book involves social media. And I think it's interesting because a lot of the time you will hear the writing advice that you should keep all that kind of stuff out. But a lot of people really responded to that because they're saying it feels like a book for them, for their generation, for what they're doing. And they relate to that because it is such a ubiquitous part of life for most people. I would say, gosh, probably from like 12 or 13 years old to probably 35 or 40 now.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, that's okay. No, I completely agree. Well, I guess I do because I wrote the book, so I have to agree with that. But I completely do agree with that where, I was always told, you know, get cell phones out of there. That's something a teacher told me when, it had to be a good 15 years ago now, in creative writing workshops and those kind of settings. But I just found, especially with this book, I felt like I would be disingenuous if I didn't have them talking about it and using social media and interacting with each other. Otherwise, they wouldn't feel like real people in the present to me if they weren't kind of mediating their relationships and friendships through kind of Twitter and Facebook, or, you know, even at the bars when they're always looking into their phones and things like that. I mean, think of the bars you go to, how many times you see that. I mean, I just don't know how to write about people in their late 20s, early 30s, if they're not doing that. I mean, I guess I do, but they're not this cast from this book, I don't think.
Right, because I'm going to admit that last night I took a picture of my beer and posted it on Facebook while I was out. And I feel kind of lame about it, but at the same time, it was a great beer, and it was an unusual beer, and that's something I enjoy. So it felt appropriate to take that picture and put a filter on it and put it on Facebook. Some of the themes, though, I thought were interesting because we think of, and we've talked about on the show, too, social media can be a really powerful force in positive ways. Like, the three of us all found each other through the Internet. Jessica and Dakota have met because they're in the same state, but I'm, like, 2,000 miles away from them.
Yeah.
So it can be a really good thing, but one of the things that seemed prevalent is that everybody in this book was using it, but they also felt very isolated and alone, and I think that's something that we do hear a lot about. We read about how, like, excessive use of Facebook is connected to depression. It may not lead to it, but it's correlated to depression. It's correlated to people feeling like they're unfulfilled in their social lives. And I think it's interesting that you were able to communicate that effectively without, like, banging people over the head with the message.
Yeah, thank you. And I do think it could go either way, where you guys use social media in a really positive way, right, where you kind of all met, you met like-minded people, you kind of fostered this real-life connection with each other. And I think in the book, the reason why they all kind of have negative reactions to it is they all use it almost like an echo chamber. So
right.
Obviously you have Sloane just counting. She's not interacting with anyone. She's interacting with herself. She's interacting with her own kind of digital avatar. And, you know, most of the other characters are doing that too. And I wanted to be clear that I definitely haven't learned the lesson of the book. People keep bringing it up to me like, I should know better because I wrote the book. But in fact, I think I've gotten worse with my social media consumption production since I've written the book, or even tonight.
You got to promote the book now, right?
What?
You got to promote the book now, so.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it started, where I'm like, I'm going to promote my book. I'm going to live stream myself. I'll play Nintendo games. I'm going to tweet more. I'm going to blog more. But really, it just becomes an echo chamber where I live tweet a lot of Knicks games, and I was live tweeting it tonight, and I was talking about this podcast and basically saying, yeah, there's a 90% chance I'll start crying in the middle of the podcast once I realize what I've just witnessed, which is total destruction of this team. And then I immediately follow that up by just saying, who the fuck am I talking to? Who am I even talking to right now? No one cares about my own little interactions with social media or the Knicks. No one cares about my fandom, and it is kind of that echo chamber effect that the characters have. But you guys seem to have done it in the right way, which is making connections and kind of fostering.
Well, granted, though, I mean, this is one example of the way we've used social media. I'm not going to say that every time I log on to Twitter or Facebook that I'm communicating something really important, right?
Or good, because she's not.
But I think that the example of Sloane, like, making the YouTube videos of counting to was 250,000 or something like that, right? Like, some just kind of an absurdly high number to watch somebody, just sit there and watch them. Like,
yeah.
But then you compare that with what you can't, like, if you spend enough time on YouTube, you will see some really worthless shit. But everybody kind of thinks, like, maybe I'll get a million views and be a celebrity.
Yeah, and it really, you know, it does seem far-fetched at first, but I don't think it's that far-fetched. And I do remember kind of clicking around. It wasn't Ustream. It was the predecessor to Ustream. Something like maybe it was Justin TV, like one of these millions of social networking things that have just fallen by the wayside. Before I was writing the book, I wanted Sloane to have some type of project, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And I saw this guy just counting into his camera. That's all he was doing. I don't think he had a goal like Sloane does, but it just struck me that this person thought that this was a valuable way to spend his time, and then I was watching it, and I was not the only one watching it. So it's kind of disturbing. We're not that far from reality. It's pretty close to where we're at.
But that's, you know, people always talk about, people love to talk about how awful the comments on internet videos and articles are. But the only way you can comment on how terrible they are is if you actually spend time reading them. Right?
Yeah, it's such a participatory culture, which kind of goes against what I was just saying about it being an echo chamber. So I'm not really sure how I feel. I guess you can't have it be an echo chamber unless you are at least consuming the kind of crappy culture being crapped out by people on YouTube. I don't know. I'm still working through how I feel about the book, even almost a year after it's been published, or 6 months.
The process. It's fine.
The thing with social networking is that it almost, you know, hinders real face-to-face interaction, you know? Like,
oh, I totally agree.
Every time I go on a date, it's like it's so awkward because, you know, everyone is talking to each other through Twitter, Facebook, or whatever, or texting, all that other bullshit, and then it's nobody has anything to say when they run into each other out in public.
Fine.
Yeah,
that's
it's really
true.
Crazy. Yeah. Yeah, we're even, even my girlfriend, like, she'll come home from work and I'll be excited to tell her some story, and then she'll already know it because I posted it on Facebook and she saw it. That happens to me all the time. It seems to happen with everybody, too. And, you know, even I teach college now, and my students, a couple years ago, when there would be breaks in the class, they would all just talk to each other and they'd make friends. And by the end of the semester, they'd all, you know each other, and, you know, some of them would go out and hang out and that type of thing. And now whenever there's a break in the class, they just all pull out their phones and talk with their friends on Facebook or Twitter or whatever the hell they're using. And it's kind of sad. I mean, maybe I'm being like old fashioned by thinking that's sad, but it seems sad that they're not actually paying attention to any flesh and blood people right around them.
That's why I'm still a smoker. Because it's like the last vestige of doing something where you will make a friend in the process. It's the last way to meet strangers. I'm being sarcastic. Well, sort of. But you do always make friends if you smoke in a public place because everyone needs a light, or they're like, oh, we're allowed to smoke here? And you're like, oh, yeah.
Gives you something to say.
Anyway, I don't know. I thought it was really cool because the other thing, too, is this idea that, like, none of the characters really seem to know who they are, but they're constantly projecting who they think they are.
Yeah.
And that's, like, realized, I guess, when we're doing this show and, like, we started doing a YouTube channel, and I write an article that people actually read, and it all makes me feel really weird. Like, I don't, like, I'm now aware of what I'm putting out into the world, and, like, what do people think that that's me? I don't know. It's an interesting thing to think through about what it means, like, if putting so much of yourself out there means that you're actually not really considering who you are because you're marketing yourself to a perceived audience.
Yeah, like the characters in the book, like especially Sloane, I think is the character who most does this, where is she the person that she's projecting herself to be when she's just counting off those numbers, that kind of nihilistic kind of hipsters, or is that just a projection that she's kind of fostering for some reason? It's interesting, and it seems to be something that more and more people are doing, especially, you know, if you follow people on Twitter first and then meet them in real life, there always seems to be this real, for the most part, a big disconnect between the way they present themselves online versus the way they actually are physically, for the most part, I find.
I think that's fair. Well, especially with Twitter, because you have to condense everything down to a bite-sized package, whether you want to or not. So the other thing I'm really excited to talk about this book is that it's so geeky.
Yes.
And I mean that in the best way. I used to write for a geek website, so like that, at least by association, right? You got the original Nintendo system, you got Star Wars, you've got Spider-Man comics, I think there's something about DuckTales in there. Like, there's all this stuff that someone like me is like, ooh, I mean, I'm not a big, everyone calm down and sit down. I'm not a big Star Wars fan. And I hope that doesn't change anyone's opinion of me as a human being, but I'm not. But
I'm hanging up the phone right now.
Yeah,
no, I'm sure Jessica and Dakota are. Yeah, it's okay. Look, it's fine. It's just whatever, okay? A lot of my friends are Star Wars fans, okay?
I never hopped on the bandwagon.
But I guess my question is that when you were working these things into the story, was that just something that came naturally because, like, that's the sort of subculture that you're in and those are your interests, and it just happened?
I wrote this book at the start, right before my final year of grad school, when I was getting my MFA at the University of Pittsburgh, and for years I had been trying to write this really sappy kind of domestic realism. Basically, I was just trying to regurgitate everything my teachers had given me. So I was writing things that were really just like copycat Carver stories for years, basically, and none of them were good. None of them were even passably readable in any way, shape, or form. And I'd written this terrible, terrible domestic working class novel set in Scranton, where I'm from. And it was just a total disaster. And my mentor at the time, and she still is, Kathy Day, she just took me aside and was like, this isn't good. You could do better. You should write from your own viewpoint or something similar, at least to your age. And you have no experience with kind of domestic realism. You know, you're not married, you're not divorced. You should just try and write something about 20-somethings. So I just started writing Last Call right after that. And I felt like I just kind of took the brakes off and kind of like allowed myself to write about people that were like me. So it just felt natural. I was never trying to cram it all in. I mean, in that period of my life, whenever I was out with friends, the conversation would always inevitably turn to kind of pop culture, and especially pop culture in the 80s that we had kind of grown up with. And it did seem as a way to kind of make a connection with someone, but it was a false connection where it felt like we were sharing something about our childhoods, but you're really not. It's just this kind of artificial experience. Like, yeah, we have probably all played DuckTales or something like that, and it makes it seem like there's a meaningful connection, but there's really not. And that kind of, for me, fit into the novel, where the characters all really want to be close to each other, but none of them are, and none of them know anything about each other, and they're just kind of floating along the surface of friendship. So it just all kind of happened, you know, and actually I ended up, by the final draft of the book, cutting a ton of it out. There was way more. I think at one point, one of my friends, Chris Lee, who read the book, pointed out that the Nintendo DuckTales game was referenced about 9 times, so I went through and scaled it down to 3. So it was a lot heavier in an earlier draft.
I think you just depressed me a little bit, because I'm like, oh, I connect with a lot of people over... Look, one of my first dates with my husband, this is embarrassing, but I ran a meetup for the Maryland, D.C. Doctor Who fans, and he's British.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'm like trying to whisper it. But he's British, so he came to one. And anyway, I'm just like, I kind of connected with my husband over pop culture. Now you're telling me that we don't have a real connection, and I'm just rethinking everything.
Your marriage was built on lies.
The sham, yeah.
No, I mean, just I think that for normal, well-adjusted people, that's probably totally valid. I think for these characters, though, they're just not they can't really get at each other, and they don't know anything about each other other than that they all kind of grew up with all this dumb shit. You know, and part of it probably came into for me because I still play Nintendo pretty heavily, where I'm standing in my living room right now, and I have a shelf. I'm looking at a shelf with about 370 Nintendo games piled up. So it's just one of those things where your hobbies kind of make it into your fiction. So my cheap hobby after probably watching the NBA is collecting old Nintendo games. So it felt like it had to be in there. He needed a hobby, so I just gave him my hobby, which could also be lazy, but it seems good.
Why not? Write what you know.
Yeah.
If you could fight any basketball player, NBA or college, who would it be?
Wait, fight anyone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Reggie Miller. Reggie Miller, without a doubt. I don't even have to think about it. It's absolutely Reggie Miller. As a diehard Knicks fan, I hated him more than anyone growing up. Because actually, Michael Jordan was the one who beat us all the time. But you could live with it because you legitimately felt that Jordan was a better player than anyone on the Knicks. You felt when they played the Knicks that Jordan was the best player on the floor. And I could live with that. I could live with losing those games. And the games that haunted me and that I still think about are the games against Reggie that we lost, And even the finals against the Rockets, I was just tweeting about that today, where I almost broke my hand as a 10-year-old just smashing my fist against the couch. And I was so enraged because it felt like we should have won. And especially Reggie's just such a little shit. Just even – I can't even watch – like, he calls a bunch of NBA games for TNT, and I have to mute it. I can't even listen to his voice because I get so aggravated. And I live in Indianapolis now. I grew up in Scranton, like I said, and that was my only trepidation against moving here, was the sheer insane thought that I could run into Reggie Miller at the supermarket or, like, at a red light or something like that. And even the most terrible thing happened to me 2 months ago, where I went to – a Pacers game when the Knicks were playing, and Reggie Miller was there calling the game, and they gave like this video ovation to him, and we had to sit through this long bullshit montage of all of his highlights, and it was probably the single most awful moment of my entire life, was sitting in the stands watching that. So that was my long rant about Reggie Miller and my absurd hatred of him as a human being.
Let's hope you never do run into him in the grocery store, because, you know, I don't know you well, but I feel like I'd be sad if you went to jail.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'd probably just start throwing up. That's probably what would happen. So I don't know how I'd react, but that's probably what it would be. It'd probably be something like that. I was going to say I'm sure he's a very nice human, but in fact I don't think that, so no, I'm not going to say that.
Good. Don't back down on your principles, sir.
No, I'm not backing down.
I used to have that, like, a weird dislike for Tara Lipinski when I was younger.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's just so, to me, that's so, how can you be passionate about figure skaters? Unless it's like, yeah, Tanya Harding, who's like, actually goes around and,
you know,
hurts people.
And it was a thing. I don't know. In case you don't know, Tara Lipinski was a U.S. figure skater for the U.S. She went to the Olympics, and she was, like, the big deal. I don't know. I just hated her face. I have that face.
I'm going to agree with you. It happens. I call it the big face. Just no.
I don't know. I didn't like her. So I understand. It's okay. I didn't have any real reason. Actually, I did, because I was a Michelle Kwan fan.
Okay. Well, there you go.
And I felt like she was, like, taking all the – what, like, she just came in, like, as an unknown and got all the attention all of a sudden. Whereas Michelle Kwan –
I think we can all agree that Michelle Kwan was the better figure skater.
She was. Okay. So,
oh,
yeah,
no doubt. Yeah.
Sorry.
Now I want to know how you feel about Brian Boitano, but that's for a different show. It's for a different show.
Sure.
You had a great
show.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I don't know where that came from.
I have no idea what's going on.
Justin has something.
We were talking about the I'm losing it. Okay. The I guess thinking about Tara Lipinski and got upset. The video because we were saying you have all the old Nintendo games and all those. Do you enjoy those more than, like, the fancy new games that are out? And why are they more fun?
I absolutely enjoy them more. I don't have anything new except for the Wii, but I really just use that to watch Netflix. I don't really have games. I guess I have the new Super Mario Brothers game, which is basically an old Mario Brothers game, but they made it look new for kids. But, yeah, I pretty much just play Nintendo because left to right – and even I think of, like, the Nintendo 64, that's, like, a new system. I think that's new Nintendo that I don't like because 3D, and there's so many buttons on the controllers. It's so complicated, so needlessly complicated. I don't know. I think there's something just inherently fun about a massive kind of share of the Nintendo catalog, those early games. Just because you could pick up and play almost all of them. I don't have instructions for most of the games. You don't really need them. It's pretty simple what you're supposed to be doing. It immediately brings you back to childhood, and they're fun to play for about 5-10 minutes. And I think that's key for me, is I don't really have a lot of time. Like, when I had a PlayStation 1, and I would sit there and play something like Final Fantasy VII or VIII or those games for like 50 hours.
Yeah,
and I would do that if I had a new system. I know that's what would happen. And I just can't allow myself to do that. I have a job and a life and things I have to do. This is perfect for me, where I could just buy like 400 of them, and they're all so cheap. Everything's like a dollar, except for the really rare games. And you know, you play it for 10 minutes, and then you're done for a while, and you don't want to play it again. And that's probably better for me. But I am interested. I'm really curious what kids now think about it. That's always really interesting to me, because it feels like it should work. It feels like if you're
right.
Five now, yeah, you should be able to like DuckTales if I give it to you, but it seems that's never the case. Every child I have tried to force this on, they just hate more than anything on earth, because I think it's maybe because it's so difficult. Or even at AWP, which is this conference, I set up my laptop with an emulator on it for people to play as they were getting a book, and they could play me. That was the prize, I guess, is they could play me in any Nintendo game. Which is the saddest prize ever. But these two children walked by, and they look so bored out of their mind because they'll just all books everywhere. And they're so excited they get to play a game, so I put DuckTales on for them. And the one girl almost started crying within about 3 minutes, where she just kept walking straight into a hole over and over. And we kept telling her, like, just play the hole. She just could not grasp why it was this difficult, why the game wasn't helping her in some way, and she just lost it. So I don't know. Maybe it is a thing that its moment has passed and it's never coming back.
Real quick, speaking of emulators, Jessica's going to love this. Have you seen the Great Gatsby Nintendo game that you can play on the emulator online?
I have.
That's a fucking
I actually
hard
interviewed
game.
Those guys.
Really?
I actually interviewed those guys on the Rumpus because I tracked them down and then asked them why they were doing it and all these questions. Yeah, I thought it was amazing. I love that game. I think it's awesome and so cool.
You probably got better in that
like
game
first
than I
have. Level, Gatsby gets abducted by aliens. And I was like, I don't remember this happening, but okay, let's go find
it. Every 6 months or so, I tell myself, I'm gonna fucking beat this game. It's gonna fucking happen today. And I spend like an hour on it, and then I'm like, ugh, give up. But I'm not very good at video games anyway. So
you kind of lose that patience you had as a kid.
Yeah.
See, when I was a kid, this is funny. We only had one controller, so we'd each take turns. When you died, it was somebody else's turn. And so that kept it exciting because you were always going to get a turn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you game over, you could always start over. Maybe you could play for hours. But when you're playing with, like, there's... You know, me, my stepsister, my cousin, and, like, the kids down the street, everyone's like, yeah, motherfucker, die. Come on, I want my turn. Very competitive.
And they're designed to be just so impossibly hard just to keep you playing because, you know, if they weren't that hard, probably each of these games takes about 7 minutes to beat, and they just jack up the difficulty, so you're just stuck there just getting massacred again and again. It's kind of great. It's kind of just hilarious how unchild friendly each of these games are. It's pretty amazing.
The games never end.
And that was like even more difficult, you know. And it's like now, new games they're designed so you don't hit that roadblock there, you know.
Oh yeah,
and what about
guide you through?
But you know, the thing is too is that you can always like now you can always save your game. It doesn't take anything. Any kind of real dedication. I know some people will play a video game for like 60 fucking, I'm going to beat this game in one sitting. But that's not what most people do. Most people save the game, they go on with their life, they come back, whatever. Back in the day, you either made it or you didn't.
If you wanted to beat Mario, you sat there and beat Mario.
That's right.
Yeah, and there's so many other external threats to the game where like, even with my Nintendo now, if I walked past it, too hard, like, while I pause the game will just reset, and I'll forget about it. Every time I'm playing and I'm drinking, I'll get halfway through a game and then, like, stomp down on the floor and the whole thing just resets. Or, like, that thing where you're playing a game and then, you know, the graphics start to get weird, You know, like letters and numbers show up on the screen, but you can still kind of make it out, and you tell yourself, like, oh, no, it's supposed to look like that. It's okay. I'm gonna make it through, but you know it's just getting worse and worse as you're going. There's all these other obstacles that are not there in the modern day.
My favorite thing is that me and a friend of mine used to pause. I don't even know which Mario Brothers game it was, but maybe it was the first one. If you paused it long enough, and here comes the part where, like, my video game knowledge sucks, but the little Venus flytrap things would jump out of the pipe.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so if you paused it and you left it paused, the thing would jump out of the pipe and, like, move around. And once it happened, you were done. Like, it wasn't, I don't think it was necessarily a good thing, but we would do it on purpose because we were like, oh, look at this cool thing we figured out how to do. Hey, Dad, come look.
Well, that's what's so fun about them. That's what I think is really so much fun, is that 90% of it is just trying to figure out what the game is supposed to be, like what you're supposed to be, what it's actually supposed to be, what you're supposed to be imagining on the screen, where new games spell everything out, obviously, because they look so realistic. But if you play something like Maniac Mansion or some like really bizarre game, the first hour is you trying to, you know, figure out what this is, like tonally, what are you observing right now?
Yeah,
I tell you, at least, and I said, I suck at video games. I've never been good at them. I'm never going to be one of those people that's like, I love video games, because I just get so frustrated. But at least the old games, you could pick them up, like you said, like, because now there's all these buttons, and there's like a guide, and there's a storyline to follow, there's all this shit going on. But the old games, you just pick them up and start pressing buttons, and eventually you'd figure out what each button did and how to get through the game. So I think when we got my brother got a PlayStation for Christmas, it was like, that was when I was like, well, that's it for me in video games. Like, we're not going any further in this relationship, because I'm never going to be able to just mash buttons and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's so much more complicated, and the narratives all make sense, and they're not kind of as quirky and fun. Like, I was just playing, Noid. Remember the Noid, the Domino's mascot?
Yeah.
they made a video game of it, and your first thought is like, what the fuck could that be? Like, if you're going to make a video game out of the Noid, what could it be? And it's just, you're the Noid, you're on a boardwalk, you're walking left to right, and you're punching birds in the face. Like, that's it. That's everything. You just pick it up, you can look at it for 1 second, and you know what you're supposed to do for the whole game. You're just walking right, punching anything you see. You know, you don't tend to get that too often anymore, I think.
You get angry on the phone. That's similar.
Well, I had Ninja Turtles original Nintendo game, and I still don't know
that shit is so hard. That's what I was talking about. The original.
That's the worst.
One, there's like, you get to a city, and then all of a sudden I couldn't figure out what to do, and I mean, hours I would just been wandering around a city. I didn't know what to do. It was hard.
I still play it. I still can't beat it. As a kid, I would get to this part where you get to a dam, and you've got to, like, swim around all this, like, electrified coral reefs and defuse bombs and shit. And it would pretty much require perfect accuracy to get through it even once. And then the game, I thought that was the end of the game when I was a kid, and it just keeps going. It just goes on forever. I don't know how anyone could beat it. It's just brutal.
Did you guys ever play the Fallout games on the, you know, on the computer?
No.
What was it?
Fallout, the computer game.
Oh,
Fallout.
Yeah, I played the first one. Yeah.
I never played the first one, and I never played any of the ones after Fallout 2. Because when I was 19, I moved in with one of my best friends from high school, and he was super into gaming, and we were broke as fuck. So all we did was like play his Sonic emulator on the computer and play Fallout. And no matter how many times I started that game over and tried to make it work, to do it differently, I'd always end up wandering the desert in Klamath Falls for months. I mean, it passed the time because we didn't have cable or anything. We had, also speaking of video games, we had whatever the Sega was, the first one that used discs. We had that with like three of the fucking weirdest video games you've ever seen in your life.
Oh, the Sega
and
Saturn.
That's what we did. Yeah, the Sega Saturn. You could get the video games on eBay for like $8 at the time.
Yeah, I have it now. I have it hooked up to my television as we speak. That's a great system. Sega Saturn's awesome.
It was, and we had some weird like trivia game that we played on it, and it was like the wildest, most nonsensical trivia game you've ever played in your life. It was definitely, it was like the precursor to the You Don't Know Jack iPad
yeah.
app.
Yeah.
It was insane.
Is that like a Dreamcast or something?
No, it was the Sega Saturn, and it was like a famous flop. Nobody had one. I think he found it, like, because he was super into video games. He knew about it, but he didn't have one. And then he found it online for sale for, like, $20 because nobody wanted them.
Like, yeah, it's a disaster. I found mine for $13 in the Goodwill, just buried with the toys. It was a happy day for me.
I think we've just spent, like, seriously, no shit, like 40 minutes talking about Facebook and video games.
Well,
it was important.
Yeah, but really, to end that subject, is there's nothing worse than Pac-Man because you can't beat it. No matter how long you play, you'll never beat it.
It teaches you a lesson about life. Just don't try. Don't try.
Don't try. My favorite thing ever was, there was a quote from somebody who worked at Nintendo in the 80s that said, obviously video games don't affect kids, because if video games affected kids, they would wander around in the dark eating magical pills listening to techno music.
That seems like a really apt criticism. Yeah, really good.
Ooh, creepy. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, it's like, ooh. So
I'm super psyched about these listener questions, though.
I'm super psyched about them, too. You want to start, Dakota?
I don't know.
Do you have it up?
Well, now,
okay.
Now it's too much pressure.
I'm stoked. I'm ready to go. David James Keaton.
I'm too drunk to read the computer screen, so.
Okay.
David
Renee's got this.
A really special moment when he was on the show because everybody left us. Okay, so I feel very connected to him, and the first listener question is from David James Keaton. And he wants you to explain your love for Weekend at Bernie's 2, or specifically, why you seem to think Weekend at Bernie's 2 makes Weekend at Bernie's 1 look like a hypothetical Weekend at Bernie's 3. And I'm super stoked about this question because I love Weekend at Bernie's. Like, are you kidding me?
I love Weekend at Bernie's unapologetically. Well, let me be clear. I love Weekend at Bernie's, too. I think Weekend at Bernie's 1 is kind of a forgettable buddy comedy of the 80s. I love wacky. Well, first let me back up even more. Dave Keaton, great guy. His book, I'm really excited about his book, which launches this week, so it'll be out when people listen to this, which I'll be at the launch event, which I'm really excited about. I'm going to go buy his book, I've known Dave forever. But then, Weekend at Bernie's. So I'm a big fan of wacky buddy comedies, and they don't make them anymore. It seems like there's no, like, Bill and Ted or Wayne's World or Weekend at Bernie's. Like, those movies don't seem to exist in the same way they did in the 80s and early 90s. But I think the first one is kind of forgettable. But what I really like is
I disagree, but go ahead.
I mean, I think it's fine. I think, I saw it. It's still okay. The second one, though, I really like when kind of mainstream movies or TV shows go completely off the rails. And I think this is kind of like Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, where the first one, totally enjoyable. And the second one, they're like, what do we do now? I don't know. Send them to hell. And then they'll go to heaven and meet aliens, and the aliens will merge into this bigger alien, and then that thing will build them robots to fight other robots. Like, that's the plot they came up with. I like shit
and
like that.
The meaning of life can be found in hair metal.
Duh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they just go to, like, a convenience store, no, like a hardware store, and just buy a bunch of vacuums and build a robot out of it. It's totally great. But Weekend at Bernie's 2, it takes place, it was filmed, like, 8 years after the first one. So everyone looks real old. Like, Jonathan Silverman looks just sad and tired, and so does, the other guy, Andrew McCarthy, looks just so tired. But it takes place the next day because the corpse has to be there. You have to have Bernie in it. But you can't make it too much after that, or the corpse decomposes. So it's got to be, like, right after that. And they just add in
a different movie.
And,
yeah.
Oh, that'd be great if they dig him up 10 years later. But they just add in voodoo and magic. Yeah, and even this, it starts to, like, bring up how morbid the concept is. Like, there's this one part where they pull him out of a suitcase because they fly into the Caribbean, which is just so absurd. And they finally acknowledge that the corpse stinks, and it's the only time in the movie that they do this. And then they kind of, like, spray cologne on him to make him smell better. But it's just such a bizarre film and kind of just completely goes off the rails, and it's really offensive in its treatment of the Caribbean. And it's kind of got this imperialistic kind of viewpoint, which is kind of odd. I have a lot of thoughts about Weekend at Bernie's, too. I've probably seen it now about 30 times. I'm kind of obsessed with it, as Dave knows. I can ramble for about 4 hours about Weekend at Bernie's, too.
I'm going to tell you something that you probably didn't know. You mentioned that they spray his body with cologne, and here's a fun fact. When I was in the Marine Corps, I spent some time injured, and they just had to find, like, a job for me to do. And somebody found out that, like, I wanted to be a writer, so they sent me to the Mortuary Affairs Unit. The Army had one, but the Marine Corps didn't, right? And they needed somebody to proofread the standard operating procedures for the Mortuary Affairs Unit of the Marine Corps. And as a result, I became involved in what equated is it was a master sergeant, which is, like, one of the highest enlisted ranks in the Marine Corps, a staff sergeant, and me, and a bunch of students, right? So they were going to have a day out. They have to take these students to the morgue and expose them to traumatically killed dead bodies because they have to know that they can handle it. You know, if you're going to pass out at the sight of a burnt corpse, you can't do this in the military, you know? So he gave me the option to either come with them or stay at my home unit where I would just be sitting around in the office doing nothing because I had an injury, right? So I went. Excuse me. I went, and they were showing us, I mean, like, think of the worst way that you could die and the longest period of time you could be dead before somebody found you. And these were the kind of bodies that they were bringing up because they needed to be sure these kids could handle it, right? They have something in the morgue that they spray on the bodies that I shit you not is called heaven scent. It's S-C-E-N-T, like it's a pun, heaven scent. It smells like heaven. It's scent from heaven. And that is a real thing that really happens in morgues. They spray.
That was nothing like Weekend at Bernie's 2. That was horrible.
What a downer.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, heaven scent is specifically formulated to make you not smell like a rotting corpse, whereas cologne's not going to do that. That's just it's
maybe
just something to think about.
The Weekend at Bernie's 2 screenwriters could have really learned from that.
I'm sure he listens.
Yeah.
Sure of it. And there's going to be a new Weekend at Bernie's film where they do dig him up and they spray him with heaven scent.
Yeah, they're going to answer all the unanswered questions from the second one, such as that.
I apologize.
I don't know. Any kind of question, I don't know.
But, I mean, come on. I realize that I set that up in a really morbid way, but how hilarious is it that they thought that they could make this deodorant spray sound nice?
I like that they named it, like, that they figured, like, yeah, I guess we have to give it a name. Let's go with that. Let's go with that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. In my experiences, it made me have a weird sense of humor.
Well, then you would love Weekend at Bernie's, too.
Exactly, and I do, but I do love Weekend at Bernie's 1. And, you know, here's the thing. As you mentioned, David Silverman and Andrew McCarthy didn't really hold up that well. But I loved Andrew McCarthy. I felt like he deserved so much better.
Yeah, they don't have much to do in these films. They don't have much acting to do. They don't do much. I mean, the most interesting part of the film is this part where these guys lose a chicken in a porno theater, and they're not even in those scenes. So.
I know I've seen Weekend at Bernie's 2, but this is why I disagree that Weekend at Bernie's 1 isn't memorable. I remember specific things. I've seen part 2, but I don't really remember much of it. But it's probably saturation levels.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, and it's kind of like diminishing returns, right? Where it's like Home Alone 2, Home Alone 3. It's the same movie. You're watching the same movie again and again. It's just with Weekend at Bernie's 2, they just added voodoo and racism trying to forget that you had two or one in the same
room.
And a shark. There's a shark.
Well, really? Why not?
Yeah.
Shit.
Okay. So, the next listener question is from Abby Mullins. Actually, there's two. Abby asked, the character in your book, Michael Bishop, seems really hung up on nostalgia. Is this on purpose, and is it because of his age coming into adulthood, or is it because of his generation, like a cultural thing? And her second question was, what is your favorite NES game?
Oh, man. I'll go with the first question first, because I talked so much, I rambled so much about NES earlier. But I'll definitely get to that, because I've got a lot of thoughts. But with the book, it was definitely on purpose, and I made sure to kind of keep hitting that, ringing that bell throughout the book. But it, to me, it seems like it's kind of a mixture of both of those things, but probably it leans more towards his generation, where, kind of like I was saying earlier, it seems whenever I would, still in, even now, whenever I'm out with people, it, conversations always come back to this intense kind of dissection of pop, just like we just did, just pop culture from when we were growing up, kind of in a really obsessive way that I certainly don't see people in their 50s doing, or maybe I missed it. Maybe they were doing it. Maybe my, and I always wonder about this, like, well, my dad was my age, he had a kid, he had a mortgage, he had I guess I do have a real job now, but he had a real job. And I can't imagine him sitting around at the bar with his friends, like, going over Brady Bunch episodes from when he was a kid. But I have no problem whatsoever imagining people my age really getting into DuckTales episodes and really going through beat through them, which is so strange and kind of just, I think, emblematic of where we are, where it takes so much longer for people now to become adults in a way, where it seems like earlier generations, you know, I mean, the teenager didn't even really exist, right? Before the 50s, that was the first teenager generation. So it does seem like that childhood is just getting extended. So I think that's part of what I was trying to get at, where now it seems to be extended, you know, up until your 30s, really, where, you know, it's socially acceptable for me to be collecting Nintendo games from the 80s, which are really children's toys. And it is kind of bizarre when you think about it, but no one thinks it's that bizarre.
I was just reading
something.
Maybe
they all do.
But I was just reading something about how, like, geeks, quote-unquote geeks, like, own pop culture right now. Like, something happened a few years ago when we all realized that, like, dude, superhero movies are cool, and oh my god, like,
yeah.
Have you seen the new Doctor Who? And it's become, like, a thing. But I think I have something that you're going to disagree with. And it rarely happens that I get to plug something I did, like, a really long time ago and get a guest to tell me I'm wrong. So I'm going to take advantage of this. A few years ago, I wrote for a website called Geek Crafts, and I still write there every once in a blue moon. But our job was to go find things that people made, like crocheted or sewed or whatever, based on geek culture. And due to that, this woman named Susan Beale was writing a book called The World of Geek Craft, completely independent of us. And she became part of the website for a time, and she asked me, is there anything you think is missing from the book? And I said, oh, what about the whole Atari NES obsession, right? And then she said, great, you want to write that essay? And I went, oh, shit. Like, I just thought it was a good idea. I didn't think you were going to ask me to write it. But my idea, and you can feel free to tell me I'm wrong, and it's all about delayed childhood, but my idea in the essay was the reason why Atari and NES have become such a part of pop culture and why people are, like, buying the Nintendo controller belt buckles and wearing the Atari t-shirts is less of a nostalgia thing and more of, like, now everybody is into Star Wars. Everybody is into superheroes. Everybody's into video games. And it's, like, sort of a way to set yourself apart as somebody who was there and to be like, this was mine before it was yours.
I'm so sorry, but I actually don't disagree a ton with that. I think I would modify it a bit for me, where I think I see a lot with even younger people, like people who are not there, kind of want to say that they were there, you know, and kind of have that cultural nerd cachet that seems to exist right now.
Right.
Because even, like, I'll have students who will be like, yeah, I'm really into The Legend of Zelda from 1985. And my first thought was like, well, one, you definitely weren't alive, obviously. And two, why would you like that? Why would you like that? Clearly you didn't grow up with it. I don't understand why you'd go back, but yeah, it does seem like there's some type of reaching back, or it seems like, you know, there's that whole, fake geek girl thing, which really infuriates me. Like anyone cares that, you know, that whole meme, like the geek girl meme and all that kind of stuff of like, yeah, let's put it down for liking our stuff. That's what the whole thing is. The whole thing is like, oh, most nerds are terrified of women.
Because someone's totally going to buy the latest Xbox to impress dudes, right?
Yeah, exactly, which is the biggest fantasy I've ever heard in my life. And it's something that really bothers me. And I just taught a comic book class, and it was mostly women. There was maybe three guys in the course. And at the end of the course, their assignment was to go to a comic book store, because I realized very early on that none of them had ever been to one. And that was, of course, the reaction was they went in and no one would talk to them, or they would be scowled at or just treated really strangely. And it's something that really infuriates me. So I think part of it is just this idea that people are out there trying to prove that they're part of something, which is just absurd.
Well, I think too, maybe it's changed from the time I wrote this essay, which was a few years ago, to now is like this, I hate using this word because it's such a weighted word, but there's this whole hipster thing of like, I was into that before you were into that. And so now everybody wants to be into it first. But I think like a few years ago that it might have had a different motivation of being like, fuck you. Like, I like NES because I grew up playing NES. And for me, it was like, I like Atari because when I was a kid, my stepdad brought out his old-ass Atari, and it was the first video game I ever played, you know? Pong was the first video game I ever fucking played. Like, I like it for that reason. Whereas, you know, now you'll see people, okay, I don't know if you're familiar with the show Supernatural, but they always play classic rock in the shows, right? And there's a super crazy fandom revolving around that show. And every so often I'll come across like some 18, 19-year-old girl that's like super in love with the guys in the show. And then she'll like start trying to write about how you're not a real fan of classic rock because blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you don't have the right to say that. You didn't know what it was before you started watching this show. Like, I don't really even have a right to define what that music is, even though I listened to it my whole life because my parents did, because it still wasn't mine, you know?
Yeah. Well, and this is why the comic book industry is dying, is exactly because of this, is because everything is aimed at kind of me and probably you and people like us, where kind of like people who grew up with this stuff, people who want the stories aimed at them, all the stories refer back to a million other stories that have happened since 1962. Or 1939 in some cases, and they just kind of try and shut out anyone who kind of saw Avengers or something like that and just wants to jump on board, you know. And well, I think it's a really horrible way to kind of, you know, run a kind of genre into the ground.
I also think, you know, there's this weird thing, and like, I grew up listening to punk rock and going to underground shows and like discovering the older bands like as I went, because the music was just something that happened at this place that we went, until someone was like, have you ever heard of this band? And I'm like, no, who are they? And they're like, it's the Descendants, you asshole, right? But there's this weird thing, want what they love to be popular, whereas me, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? I just went to the mall and I bought a pair of shoes with Iron Man on them. I couldn't do that 5 years ago. If I wanted Iron Man shoes, I would have had to learn how to draw and buy a pair of white Keds and fucking draw them. I'm so stoked that I can buy Iron Man shoes. But, you know, I love that people love the things I love. I love going, you know, I don't know. But that's my thing. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe it's better to keep it elite. Because I did read an article about how the whole superhero movie thing is a bubble is about to burst. Because you have... these things are crazy successes, and they're made by people who love the source material, but then the studios realize that they're crazy successes, and people who aren't involved in, like, the comic book culture really love them, so then the studios are going to want more control and make it more widely accessible, and eventually they're all going to start sucking, and we'll move on to the next thing, much like we did when the people who were huge film nerds started making films, and that bubble sort of bursted after about 13 years, and they pointed out that superhero movies got popular in 2000, and it's 2013.
Yeah, but I think there are always, it will be a genre now going forward, just in the way that, you know, there's still Westerns every once in a while. There's still musicals. It's not every movie, but they still happen. I think that's eventually what will happen with superhero movies. That's my hope, is that they continue on even after the bubble burst.
My hope is that they don't make any more Iron Man movies after Robert Downey Jr. gives it up. That's my personal hope. Maybe that makes me a bad person, but I can't imagine it done any other way than the way it's been done. And I'm going to see an Iron Man movie marathon tomorrow. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
So I think we're running close on time. And
we are.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the question that I was really excited about hearing the answer to, which is about, which is from David James Keaton, and he asked, so what really happened to the Spider-Man ring he gave you in Vegas?
Ooh.
All right, well, let me give you some background on this story, and I won't go too long on this one. Dave and I were going to Vegas together for a wedding. So we're in the airport, we're getting ready to get on the flight. And, well, I'll tell you how we got to the airport. Dave's mother had to pick us up, and she's like, "Hi, Davey, how are you doing?" And it was totally amazing. And I was sitting in the back, like, this is the best experience ever. And Dave's stepdad was there, too. And they gave Dave a GPS, because Dave gets lost everywhere. If you know Dave for, like, 2 minutes, he can't find his way around any city, any place. He would call me for directions going to the bars that I wasn't even at, and I would just navigate him there from my house. So they give him this GPS. He loses the GPS by the time we're in the parking lot of the airport. So anyway, we're sitting in the airport, and he, you know, he lost the GPS. He doesn't know where our flight is. He's just following me around like a child. And he opens his bag, and he's brought something with him. So I'm glad that he's brought some type of kind of he's prepared in some way for this trip. And it's a Spider-Man. He pulls it out. It's a Spider-Man ring, and he describes it as a Spider-Man fighting ring. And he's like, "This is for when we get in fights, you can punch someone in the face, and you'll be the Spider-Man mark on their face." And my first thought was,
metal?
How many fights? What?
Was it metal? It was like a real ring.
Yeah, it was metal. It was like a metal ring. I don't know where he found it. This is a total Dave Keaton thing, where even I was driving through Louisville. I'm going to do a flashback within a flashback, which I'm always telling my students not to do. But I was driving through Louisville just a few weeks ago with my students, and they like Dave's work, so I decided I'd stop in Louisville and eat dinner with Dave. And he just, for no reason, just brought a bag of weapons to show my students. So he had, like, brass knuckles and, like, a police stick, and he also had an ant farm with him. Like, this is just how Dave thinks. This is what he thinks is acceptable for a human to do. So he gives me the ring.
His episode was the weirdest episode we've ever done.
Well, he's probably the weirdest person you'll ever meet, so it makes perfect sense that would be your strangest episode. But he gives me the ring, and my first thought is, like, how many fights are we going to get into? Like, how many fights does Dave think we're going to get into on this trip? Which apparently was very many. And we get to Vegas, and I just got drunk immediately. I was in the bag within seconds of us arriving. I think, oh, and Dave also sat next to someone on the plane and just threw up on him, basically. So Dave has throw up all over himself. We're in the casino. And I'm just plastered. I lost the ring, basically. I got drunk. I don't remember what happened. I don't know where the ring went. But I will tell you this. That night, when I got home to the hotel room, me and Dave shared a room. And it was the best sleep I ever had. Because as I was falling asleep, Dave tucked me into bed. And he turns on the TV. And he puts on Saved by the Bell, the season where they all live in a on a beach in a hotel. You know
oh
what I'm talking
God.
About?
I remember that.
I don't know.
Yeah, and it's just like 5 episodes where they're on this beach, and Dave is just narrating the events to me as I was lulled to sleep, just telling me what Zach was doing on the beach, and it was wonderful. So that's my going to Vegas with Dave Keaton, the Spider-Man fighting ring story.
I got to get a Spider-Man fighting ring. I mean, well, there are other superheroes I'd choose first, but if Spider-Man was the only one available, Spider-Man. Okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We should have had the Books and Booze meet up in Vegas. Why didn't we think of that?
People disagreed with the idea, okay?
I disagreed with it. Damn it, I couldn't be there.
I was in a car and drive, and I would have been in Vegas. Now I have to buy – I bought a plane ticket. I don't want to talk about it. I was down for Vegas, even though I'm not a big fan of Vegas, because it's close.
Next one for the West Coast meetup.
I'm down for that. I'm okay with that. We'll make a note. Okay, so we're totally, we just geeked this episode all the way over the hour mark. We're in space right now, but we have a really special treat. We are going to be the first people to officially play the new Paris and the Hiltons track, Nightmare Body. It's been shared a little bit by Phil Jordan, friend of the show. He's been a guest. We've played his music several times. It's been shared by him on Facebook, but we're the first people to officially debut this song. And I want to talk about it for a minute because we love Phil. We love Paris and the Hiltons. And right now, Paris and the Hiltons is trying to record their first studio album. Every album up until now has been completely free. They've made it on their own time, with their own money. They put it out there. You can find them on Bandcamp. This album is going to be different, and it's going to take some money. So Phil has started an Indiegogo campaign, and we'll link it up. There are some really amazing rewards for this Indiegogo campaign. You can get a poem written for you by Phil Jordan, author of Praise of Motherhood and Such Precision, What Restraint. There is a level where you can get Phil to write you a song using your name and just about anything that you want him to sing about. There is another level where Phil will then perform said song for you on a video while wearing a dress. He is not above sacrificing his dignity for your pleasure if you can help him make this album happen. And as a huge Paris and the Hiltons fan, I really want this album to happen. I think Jessica and Dakota would agree with me. Would you agree with me? Okay, because there's like no response to that. So we're going to play this song. If you like the song, click the link, throw some cash at it. If you don't like the song, what is wrong with you? Honestly. And that's that. And there's as always, there's going to be a link to Books and Booze Live in St. Louis, which we've established is not in Vegas. And
buy Fish Bites Cop, because that just came out today.
And I'll link
that yesterday.
And David is going to be reading at Books and Booze Live in St. Louis. You've heard the legends. Now meet the man. How cool is that, right? I don't know if Sal's going to be there. He hasn't said. He hasn't RSVP'd. But now he knows that if he looks at his episode of Books and Booze, he can click the graphic of the Books and Booze Live in St. Louis, and he can RSVP to the event page on Facebook.
Absolutely RSVP.
Yes.
I will absolutely tell you whether or not.
Yeah, you will know for sure. Wait, when can I ask, when is it for your listeners and not for me? Because I already know.
June 22nd at Cicero's on the University Loop.
Okay, wait, June 22nd?
Yes.
Is that a Monday?
No, it's a Saturday.
Saturday.
Oh, okay, I will see you there.
Awesome. There you go, guys. There you go.
You can come attack me with fighting rings.
You can attack him with your Spider-Man fighting ring if you're lucky enough to have one. And maybe he'll wear an NES belt buckle. I'm just spitballing. I don't know. But he might. It's a possibility. Nothing's impossible.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was really great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for being here.
This is a great episode. Any episode where I'm allowed to fully geek out, I'm down for. Anyway, so boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, Nightmare Body by Paris and the Hiltons. Finish your drink, kick back, listen to the song, and then click the fucking button and donate some money.
behind a wall and wait. When I wear a skirt, I hate myself.